In the beginning. It's an interesting truth that before Hinduism and Buddhism and Judaism and Christianity and Islam, the people believed in gods and goddesses that they turned to when in need. Roman, Greek, Nordic, Celtic, Welsh gods and goddesses offered legends of meaning and guidance to the first peoples. But before religion and the legend, it is believed that humankind, the ones that survived, that is, were those who had developed what evolutionary scientists call a hypersensitive agency detecting device, or HADD, H-A-D-D. This is the mechanism that enables humans to perceive that many things have agency, or the ability to act of their own accord, like the sun, the moon, stars, rivers, animals, rustling grass, all move, contain energy, and thus these actions must mean something. As a species, we evolved to look deeper into that rustling of the grass and believe that there was something going on in that grass, a breeze, a friend, a foe, or even a predator. And it was having this gut feeling, the desire to look deeper into that grass for what might be behind its moving, and the energies and events and all of that had meaning. This is what I call seeking for deeper meaning. And it helped our ancestors to realize and react like fight or flight, therefore survive. So that's the thought of the day. Beyond this hypersensitive agency, it was a small step for humankind to share stories, develop legends, rituals, and religions to share wisdom. Right? It seems like, okay, there's grass rustling, this means that. Oh my gosh, the water from the beach has swept way out, we need to run to the mountains. Right? Like there was these legends that really protected societies. These stories would help our ancestors to see patterns and similarities and ultimately would inform and keep us safe. There are some who believe that big religions help to evolve big societies. This is anthropologically unfounded. Yet religion has been seen as a way to get and keep people on the same page, behaving appropriately and knowing the difference between right and wrong, basically keeping people in line. Now, Karl Marx once explained that religion is opium for the people. Have you heard that? Yeah. Is it, or does religion provide a cohesive system of conduct, standardized belief, and ultimately a place that could offer a sense of security during times of uncertainty? I think of sanctuary as a model of that to a certain extent. Many of us were brought up in religious communities that offered such lessons, traditions, guidance, penance, and forgiveness. I personally believe that what we share has a bit more to do with being a community of seekers. How many of us feel in our gut that there is something more than what we're able to perceive in this world? Like there's just something there. Maybe it starts with an idea. Then setting an intention, cultivating energy in oneself and community, and then acting to bring the idea to fruition. I think of that station project as one of those things. It's kind of like magic, because it starts with an idea. It starts with intention. And then we go from there. People wonder, is there magic in the world? Oh, I think so. We create it. It all begins right there. With that sense of belief and that sense of wonder, that place that calls us to be aware of what is going on around us and acting on those feelings. It's part of our fundamental nature to want to look deeper into The printer didn't work, so it printed double-sided, sorry. I'm like, it's not where I'm going. This moment, look into this moment. Spiritual practices, religion, social justice, ritual, tradition, they all provide one with a framework to wonder within and to wander within, to ask questions and find answers and then to respond. Setting intention. Look around us. What do you see? A wreath. What does it mean? Any guesses?
Circle of life.
Circle of life. Anything else?
Evergreen.
We are in the midst of one of the holiest times of year. We began with the celebration of Hanukkah from December 2nd to the 10th, a celebration of the rededication of the temple in Jerusalem. The menorah is lit, and the story is shared that a miracle took place where the oil that should have only lasted one day lasted for 8 full days. Bringing that light into the darkness and celebrating continued with the tribes of Europe that celebrated for millennia the concept of midwinter and the longest night, known as the winter solstice, which actually occurs this Friday, December 21st at 5:23 p.m., a time of merriment when the people believed, because it looked that way, that the sun literally stood still for 12 days. Throughout history, we have honored and do honor midwinter and the solstice in many ways. Like all of the live greens and the red boughs, the wreaths, the Christmas trees, or the trees in general, long before Christmas, there were legends, traditions, and celebrations galore that described what the solstices actually meant to the people. In celebration of winter solstice, tribal people, the people of Rome, partied hardy. They participated in rituals and bonfires in order to entice the sun to return to the northern hemisphere. You see, they believed the sun had the ability to make that decision. Ancient people believed that if the colors and the candles and the fires were big and bright enough, that the sun would possibly glance our way and couldn't resist to rush back and participate in the party. I think it's actually a good strategy. In honor of the traditions of Yule on Saturday the 22nd, the Earth-centered tribe, as I like to call them, will celebrate with legend, invoke the goddess, call the directions, and engage in all the trappings of the winter solstice here at First Parish. You are welcome. This practice of celebrating Yule originated with Germanic, Old Norse, Icelandic, Faroese, Norwegian, Danish, and Swedish tribes, and continues to be celebrated. Yule was a celebration that spanned 12 days maybe, and which grew in popularity over the centuries by many who sought solace from and meaning in the cold and dark. Ancient communities shared stories and participated in rituals around this time of the year. The Celts, led by the Druids, were among those who adopted the celebration of Yule. Similarly, the Roman Empire celebrated Saturnalia before the Common Era, which derived from older farming-related rituals of midwinter and the winter solstice, especially the practice of offering gifts or sacrifices to the gods during the winter sowing season. What came first, the chicken or the egg? One might never know, actually. Saturnalia, Yule, or the Persian birthday celebration of the invincible sun god Mithras, it is believed that Yule, Saturnalia, and the birthday part of the sun god helped to evolve the traditions that we now know as Christmas. Even with the Catholic overlay of theology on Yule and the birth of Christmas, many of our beloved traditions are not located in the theology of the holiday. I'm going to ask you about this. But instead, the ancient traditions and the rituals of our ancestors, like evergreen and holly, and music, and singing, and stories, and feasting, adult beverages, and let's not forget the red-suited gift-giving king. The question that sparked for me for this sermon, the auction sermon, that the First Parish Earth-Centered Tribe was pondering is, are we, all of us, a little bit pagan at heart? What did I hear? Oh, yeah. I know that the word pagan may stick with some of us, a bit because in ancient times, pagan was a dirty word. It was used in a derogatory way. But let me just put this out there. So was Unitarian. You see what I'm talking about? What if we expand the title of pagan and imagine instead someone who is a lover of ancient traditions? and rituals and music and merriment. What better time to consider this question, do we all love the ancient traditions, than on the Sunday before Yule? To better unpack ancient times, we need to imagine that when people told stories, they may have embellished just a little bit. That is a mark of a good storyteller, right? We also have to imagine that Christmas and the story of the birth of Jesus is as much a legend as the battle between the holly and oak kings over the return of the sun. I can only imagine all of the stories and parties going on in the ancient world. It must have been, like, amazing. Who was first? What was true? What tradition comes from where? How can we know for sure? Where do we turn when we want to know the truth about legend or any story, really? Any guesses on where we turn? I personally turn to the website called Snopes. It is the authority. What? Snopes. Yeah, isn't it Snopes or is it Scopes? Snopes. Scope. Yeah. It's one of the two. There's a C or an N. I'm not sure. You'll have to check to make sure. It is the authority on fact versus fiction because the folks take the time daily to do battle against misinformation, and they explained about this time of year on their website. It is important to note, they say, that for 2 centuries after Christ's birth, no one knew and few people cared exactly when he was born. Birthdays were unimportant. Death days counted. Besides, Christ was divine and his natural birth was deliberately played down. In fact, the church even announced at one point that it was sinful to contemplate observing Christ's birthday, as though he were a king pharaoh. The idea of celebrating the nativity on December 25th was first suggested early in the 4th century Common Era, a clever move on the part of church fathers who were endeavoring to create a state religion at the time, and who wished to eclipse the December 25th festivities of a very popular rival pagan religion, Mithraism, which threatened to the very existence of Christianity itself. On December 25th, the date of the winter solstice, pagan Romans, still in the majority, celebrated Natalis Solis Invicti, birthday of the invincible sun god, Mithras. Mithras cult originated in Persia and rooted itself in the Roman world in the 1st century before Common Era. By the early 300s Common Era, the rising religion of Christianity, legitimized by Constantine, was posing a formidable challenge to the sun worshippers, especially after the Edict of Milan issued by Roman Emperor Constantine I in 313 Common Era allowed Christians to practice their faith in the Roman Empire. Constantine, a lifelong pagan, was only baptized as a Catholic at the end of his life, when he was literally on his deathbed. In those tenuous early days of Christianity, however, church fathers debated strategies for supplanting the Mithras cult with their own religion, since it was well known that Roman patricians and plebeians alike enjoyed festivals of a protracted nature. Long. 12 days, maybe? Christians recognized that they needed an alternative to the December celebration of Natalis Solis Invicti. They needed a celebration in which all participants, Mithraists, Christians, and those pagans in between, that they could take part in and have pride about. Accordingly, the church officially recognized Christ's birth and to offer head-on competition to the sun worshippers' popular feast. The church located the nativity, any guesses? December 25th. The mode of observance would be characteristically prayerful, or prayerful, a mass, in fact, Christ's mass, as one theologian wrote around 320 Common Era. Christmas. As Snopes has confirmed, history has preserved some of the steps that were taken from Saturnalia to Yule to Christmas. Pagans, or heathens, as I love to be thought of, were called such because they were not baptized and confirmed as a Christian. So if you don't consider yourself a Christian, you're a pagan, per their definition. They followed their beloved customs regardless and tolerated the overlay of the new religion of the time because they were a peace-loving people. They were like, yeah, okay, let's all party together. It's good. Mostly. This gave leave for the Catholic Church to interweave their own beliefs and traditions over the prevailing pagan practices, literally co-opting the non-Christian people's faith. Holy ground and the pagan temples were raised to provide the sacred land for churches and cathedrals. I can only imagine it was probably, I don't want to really make this comparison, but I'm going to anyways, which is probably a bad idea. But anyways, it's kind of like the meeting house. Let's just let everybody come in and participate. And I think that that's what the Catholic Church probably did early on. And so everybody did. And then, you know, they started to get a little stricter. And they started to outlaw over time specific practices. The Catholics have always played the long game, and people who didn't toe the line became known as witches or consorts with the devil, thus persecuted, tortured, and killed. Religion endeavored over and over to conquer the beliefs, rituals, and sacred places of the first peoples. Places like Stonehenge or Avebury with the standing stones. The people that consecrated and conducted rituals at for centuries were avoided out of fear, because they were afraid to go there, afraid to be seen, because they didn't want to be persecuted. Even through persecution, the newly baptized refused to let go of the goddess worship. And I love this part. So Mary was introduced into the religion as the mother of Jesus, and the feminine aspect of Catholicism and the state-run church gained ground in traditionally goddess-centered pagan regions. So when they needed the goddess, they went and got the goddess. The so-called pagans, as I mentioned earlier, was a derogatory term that referred to anyone who is not Judeo-Christian Islamic lineage, such as Hindus and Buddhists or any earth-centered folks, regardless of how spiritually or religious one might be. These devotees had all of the trappings of religion, rituals, holidays, clergy that in Europe consisted of the Druids, who were the ancient religious leaders, scientists, and researchers of tribal societies. So just like the Catholic clergy, there were the Celtic clergy, the Druids. The pagan religions tended to be balanced with regard to gender. For centuries, thanks to the Romans, there was a common misconception that Druids were only male. However, numerous historical records attest to the fact that there were, in fact, women among their ranks. Some wise women made it into the accounts of Roman history, but seldom. They were a firm patriarchy. They participated equally in all things and were known in some areas as the Banduri. I love that name. Kind of like bandits, right? And were revered for their skill and knowledge. I'm personally fascinated by the Druids, who were considered the intellectual elite of ancient European world, similar in many ways to the medicine women and men of all around our world. The Druids performed their duties. It was a tribal function, but they were also poets and astronomers, magicians and astrologers. It literally took a person 19 to 20 years to gain the necessary knowledge and skills in alchemy and medicine, law and sciences, and more to be known as a Druid. So it was a very much a educated role in the tribe. These clergy organized intellectual life, judicial processes, had skills to heal people, and were involved in developing strategies for war. They provided an oasis of wisdom and were highly respected in their society. The Druids held and taught their people's oral history, and the bards sang songs of their legends. It was like an amazing kind of similarity to what we have at First Parish. You sing our oral history and I preach it. As the Roman Empire expanded into Germany and France, England, Scotland, and Ireland, the Romans literally killed many Druids and destroyed most of their volumes that were written. The Roman Catholic Church believed that female Druids were sorcerers and witches in league with the devil. Hence, the patriarchy flourished as the wise women were feared, persecuted, and murdered. Smart and powerful women were always a scary thing. The invading Romans also saw the knowledge of the Celts as a huge danger for their domination. The well-known Catholic Saint Patrick, how many people believe Saint Patrick was Irish? He was actually a Roman. He was a Roman who was enslaved in Ireland in his young life, then went back to Rome, then came back to Ireland to drive out the snakes from Ireland, which were also known as the pagans. He alone burned more than 100 Druid books and destroyed many places connected with the first religions. He did this while co-opting the beliefs, rituals, as well as the symbolism of the pagans, overlaying and interweaving the Roman Catholic creed in order to make what was left indistinguishable. With the balance of the pagans converted or killed, the Roman Catholic priests built churches with local labor and local money, and thus became the eyes and ears and the status quo of the Roman Empire, keeping everyone on the same page. Marx wasn't too far off. And yet, in and amongst the Catholic, Christian, and cultural doctrine, we can still see a glimmer of the traditions of our ancestors. If we strip away the Judeo-Christian overlay, we will find Yule and Saturnalia surviving and reveling. I would put forth, in answering the question of our First Parish Earth-Centered Tribe, that the beliefs, joys, concerns, rituals, and way of life of our ancestors is still very much a part of our way of everyday living. Whether we are talking about Yule or Christmas, Beltane, May, Earth Day, or Samhain, Day of the Dead and All Souls, the rituals and the beliefs of our ancestors have survived in somewhat obscured but still plain sight. Right? You, as the Earth-Centered group, have chosen to embrace the legends, the rituals, and the practices of a mystical, yet more pragmatic time, and I applaud you for the carrying on of ancient traditions. Personally, I think that we should come out of the broom closet, all of us, and dare to practice all the traditions on midwinter. What are we afraid of? I'd invite us to stop for a second, to put aside the constraints of our cultural adaptation that has placed us in this context, and instead, but deep, look deeply within. We might just get that gut feeling, that hypersensitive agency detecting device kind of feeling that would show us the import of our connection to the old ways. What is it about Christmas that we love? I mean, really, what is it that we love? Is it the stories about the birth of a baby in a manger and the ensuing religious and political ramifications of his birth and death? Or is it the evergreens, the singing, the candlelight in the darkness? It may be all of it for some of us, and yet we cannot deny the call of our most basic nature held within the rituals of our ancestors. I feel called to share my thoughts today, I don't know why, well, I do know why, on being a Unitarian Universalist. And a story about when I first became a Unitarian Universalist, because maybe this will answer something that you've all sort of been wondering. Pretty soon after taking the classes and signing the book, someone asked me in the congregation what kind of Unitarian Universalist I was. I fought my initial desire to claim being a chocolate-filled Unitarian Universalist. I love chocolate that much. But that question was had a perplexing tone or understanding for me. How could I quantify myself adequately, and why did I have to? Does anybody feel that? Have you felt that? How many Christian New Year's do we have? How many pagan New Year's do we have? How many Buddhist New Year's do we have? Hindu, Jewish, Muslim. I mean, we have lots of different types of New Year's. My journey throughout my life transversed many a landscape. I was born and baptized a Catholic, kind of like Constantine against his will. Hindu, Buddhist, Euro-pagan, Earth-centered, transcendentalist, humanist, agnostic, and more recently, what I like to call transient. I couldn't nor did I want to let go of any of it. It was all important as far as my journey was concerned. Each connection that I made on my journey has meant so much to me. Then I realized that as a Unitarian Universalist, we do not have to stake a claim about our beliefs. And this is what I love about being a you more than anything else. That if we are a Buddhist today, and there's something that speaks to us in Hinduism or Catholicism or Christianity, we can go there. And we can still be a Unitarian Universalist. It's kind of cool. We have the freedom to seek for truth and meaning in everything that we come in contact with. We have 7 guiding principles that you all know that that remind us of our conduct and focus on the journey. And as you use, we are encouraged to draw from many sources. Do you know the implications of this commitment? Anybody? Lots of homework. That's what I mean. Right? It's lots of homework. And it also means that we have to stop enough to listen to each other, talk about our respective beliefs, and try to, like, meet people where they're at. So with that, I'm just going to take a second and talk about what these purposes are all about. So the direct experience of that transcending mystery and wonder affirmed in all cultures, which moves us to a renewal of the spirit and an openness to the forces which create and uphold life. Words and deeds of prophetic women and men which challenge us to confront powers and structures of evil with justice, compassion, and the transforming power of love. Wisdom from the world's religions, all of them equally, which inspires us in our ethical and spiritual life. Jewish and Christian teachings which call us to respond to God's love by loving our neighbors as ourselves. Humanist teachings which counsel us to heed the guidance of reason and the results of science and warn us against idolatries of the mind and spirit. Spiritual teachings of earth-centered traditions, such as our earth-centered group, Embraces, which celebrates the sacred circle of life and instruct us to live in harmony with the rhythms of nature. It's all in there. I want it all. I don't know about you, but I want it all. And personally, I can have it all because I am a Unitarian Universalist. Plain and simple. And I honor the journey that we are each on. So if you ask me what kind of UU I am from now going to say a chocolate-filled Unitarian Universalist and be done with it. This life's journey, we try to wholeheartedly be present in this life to all that we encounter and to have an open heart and mind to evolving as we learn and grow. You can do that here. There is no doubt in my mind that we each endeavor to be good people and to live lives that strive towards being ever better people, to see and to know what is right and to witness and stand for all that is right in this life as we see it. It is true that at times we falter or lose sight, as did our forebears, but when we see or experience persecution and oppression, we know it for what it is, and that is when we feel called to act. That is our prayer. Service is our prayer. The tribal wise people, the Druids, Banduri, medicine women and men, knew this, and we know it inherently. We are the seekers and the finders of our times. We come from a long line of seekers, many of them who claimed earth-centered pagan practices from the very beginning. They found their way to these shores, and it is now up to us to embrace without fear all of the wisdom that is part of our human legacy. Yes, my friends, let me put an end to this question. We are all a little bit pagan. I invite us to go ahead and jump right into Yule and Christmas with both feet, dare to embrace all that comes with this midwinter celebrating and everything it has to offer. I'd like to be the first one to say, welcome Yule. Let us take a moment in silent reflection, meditation, and prayer.